Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 16 of Logicast, the AWS News podcast brought to you by Logicarta. I'm Carl Robinson, CEO and co-founder of Logicarta, and I'm joined, as always, by my colleague, lead cloud engineer, John Goodall. How are you doing today, John?
I'm not so bad. I'm going to be exhausted by Thursday, but right now I'm okay.
Yeah, busy week ahead with the summit. You've cut your hair especially.
Well, I attacked my face with a beard trimmer because I looked like I lived under a bridge.
But that's kind of normal in the tech industry, isn't it? I mean, we're going to a tech conference. That look, I'm sure, will pass muster.
I forget where I saw the cartoon, but I saw it was like a comparison of the 90s and now, and it was tech engineers, clean shaven, high and tight, with the collared shirt and all the rest of it, versus lumberjacks with the plaid and the axe. And then 2020, flip them round, but you know, they're both holding laptops.
Well, staying on the subject of beards, we are joined today for the third time, which I think is a first, that we've had a guest on for the third time. But we are joined again by AWS hero, among other community titles, Brian Tarbox. How are you doing today, Brian?
I'm doing great. And I'm going for the ZZ Top look.
Not Frank Beard, because he was the only one who didn't have a beard.
Yeah. At Canlin, we do have sort of a tradition of fairly long beards.
Is it like a contest? Do you get judged on those at the end of the year? Or?
There are points. There are points awarded.
Have you so ever grown Brian, up long enough to plait it and put like beard rings in it?
I haven't gone that far.
I think it's already long enough, though. It's just whether you choose to do that with it or not.
So, yeah. No. I think I might draw the line there.
So, Brian, for the listeners that haven't heard your previous episodes, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do for a living.
Okay. Hi, Brian Tarbox. I work for Canlin, which is a premier AWS consulting partner. And oh my God, Canlin! I'm almost a year there, and the honeymoon has not worn off. Canlin is still the real deal. Smart people who are incredibly nice. Oh my God! We help people design, systems in Amazon. We have a particular focus on Gen AI, as everyone claims that they do. But we've been doing it for a long time. My master's thesis back in 1987 was actually in AI. So back when I was working with dolphins. So I'm a community hero, Amazon ambassador, Alexa champion, new voices mentor, user group leader. So as my wife would say, that just means the most dangerous place in the world is to get between me and a microphone. I'll own that.
Nice. Well, as you mentioned AI, before we start on the articles.
You're so desperate to get into it, aren't you?
I've forgotten my usual preamble.
I know. We danced around not talking about AI for ages, and now it's like, quick, get in there, get it done.
AI, let's just get on with the AI. But before we get on with the AI, we're not here to talk about beards, which is what we've been talking about. Regular listeners to the podcast will know that once a week, I curate a list of AWS news, which I share via my weekly AWS News Roundup newsletter. And then John and I pick a subset of the articles that we'd like to talk about with our guest on the podcast. And as you may have guessed by my eagerness to start talking about AI, the first of this week's articles is indeed about AI. And it's an announcement that Anthropic's Claude 3 Opus model is now available on Amazon Bedrock. So what are your thoughts on this one, John?
Well, they didn't fit with their release cadence that was sort of unofficial and kind of worked, because they'd done it, they did Haiku and then Sonnet kind of 3 weeks apart from each other, and then we were all sort of expecting Opus to come along 3 weeks later, and then it didn't. I was like, well, okay, but now it's out. Great, brilliant. Opus is, they call it the most intelligent. I mean, we had this when we had Stephen Sennett on, I think, and we both disagreed with the use of the word intelligent, because it's an artificial intelligence. I don't like the term intelligent personally, but it's certainly the most capable of the LLMs that they've got going. You look at the graph that they put out on the last service announcement, I think, and it's the most capable, it's the most expensive, but then it's kind of bang for buck. You pay more, you get more. I think it's got the most tokens going. It you know, they've got bits and pieces in here as well saying best in market performance on highly complex tasks. And I think it's been benchmarked against GPT-4, and it's kind of same sort of playing field, might be a bit better than GPT-4, certainly better than 3.5. And now it's out in Bedrock, which is great. It's available, however, only in Oregon. So which is one of the oddities about Bedrock is Bedrock is available in a subset of AWS regions, like it's not in London for some reason. And it's not in Ireland, but it's in Stockholm and it's in Oregon and North Virginia.
And Sydney, as we discussed last week.
Mm. Which is, yeah, it's just odd. But not every model is available in every region. So depending on where you are, what your workload is, you might have to cope with the fact that you can't run everything where you want to. Like as a case in point, we run this podcast, as we've kind of alluded to a few times, through a Bedrock-based processing system that, you know, transcribes it using Transcribe and then spits out some bits and pieces that we use for show notes and titles and kind of all the rest of it. It's just a nice reminder so we don't have to remember what we prattled on about for half an hour. But that's run out of North Virginia because I couldn't do it in London. Bedrock's not in London. So I stuck it in North Virginia because, obviously, that's using Claude 2 because that's what was available at the time. If I want to move that to go and use Claude 3 Opus, which I do, I'm going to have to redeploy everything to Oregon. Or just wait for it to come to North Virginia, one of the two.
Right, but you deployed everything in the first place using infrastructure as code, right?
I mean, so yes. it's trivial, but I've got to complain about something, Brian.
Right. Well, I love the fact that you said you don't like the term intelligence because. Here in America, we clearly don't like the term intelligence. Forget artificial, just intelligence.
I think, yeah, there was. I complain about this as well because I complain about a lot of things. I don't like the term thought leader because it feels very Orwellian, but then people don't like the word expert anymore. So you've got to come up with another word that means the same sort of thing.
Evangelist. Yeah. I mean, well, because you certainly don't want to say influencer. I actually don't mind that either. So in playing with these models, there's the objective bits of, you know, token, max tokens, tokens per second, and so on. But there's also just the sort of the style it generates. So I've been thinking lately about deepfakes and how can you tell and so on. And I actually was writing a blog about, I don't know if you remember the old Heinlein book, Stranger in a Strange Land, they introduced the concept of what they called a fair witness. And it was an individual whose profession was to be a trained reporter of exactly what they saw, you know, without interpretation. So being lazy, of course, I asked, you know, I went into Perplexity and I said, you know, write me an article describing deepfakes and how fair witnesses would work. And then I switched Claude models. And it wasn't just that it was faster in that the tone of what it generated was very different. And, you know, I use these as starting places. That's not what I publish, you know, but I use it as a starting point. But I haven't gone really through and looked at the two and say, because they're so different. It's like, these are almost like completely different people generated this. So it's intriguing. That's a whole subjective thing that I don't know that we have great evaluations for yet.
Well, no, because they're all non-deterministic as well, which is really very annoying, especially when you're trying to do something quite, I don't know, not mundane, but like repeated, like we're trying to do with the kind of auto-summarization. I want it to look the same and kind of same tone of voice and do the same thing every single time. And even within the same model, it disagrees with itself from, well, different inputs, different outputs, but even the style changes. Okay, didn't ask for that. But cool, we'll work with it.
Yeah.
And it makes stuff up as well, as we found. I don't know which model that was, John, that was when we asked it to transcribe and summarize the podcast. It was making up jokes that we hadn't even said. It didn't like the jokes that we had said, I guess. No. I tried to do better. But speaking of deepfakes,
of the Bedrock thing, because you give it a temperature. We gave it, I think, 50%. Mm. So it was 50% randomness, whatever randomness actually means. It's like the Cloudflare randomness of just, here's a wall of lava lamps and you can use them for randomness. I don't know.
I think we are experts at randomness.
I mean, I have a lava lamp over there.
Yeah. Let's not get started on that again. That was a previous episode. But now on the subject of deepfakes, I did actually receive a video message from Joe Biden today advising me that one of my friends is coming on our motorbike trip in September. Quite how we managed to create that, I don't know, but just shows you how easy it is these days to create this stuff.
Right. It's quite hard to detect. I mean, I've got a I actually chat with some folks at a federal agency that I'm not allowed to name. It's not secret. It's just they haven't been cleared. And they're asking me about how do you detect deepfakes? And I said, well, we don't have a great answer. I mean, the major models have watermarks, and we all know that watermarks can't possibly be removed. as people develop their own models, they're not obliged to put in watermarks. So it's a, you know, and so given that, and given that eyewitness testimony is fallible, it's an unsolved problem right now.
They still give Uncanny Valley a little bit. And if you dig into the, go really off topic now, but if you dig into the history behind where Uncanny Valley comes from, that's all really concerning. We needed to work out a way of determining what looked human but wasn't quite human.
Yes. I think that's fascinating. Really uneasy. That's the most interesting thing. What was predating on us that looked kind of human?
Yeah. you could go completely off the deep end with this one. It's, yeah.
Well, it's alien versus predator, right? So.
Well, on that note, let's try and get back on track and talk about AWS news. Our second article for this week is, again, another feature announcement on the Amazon website. And this one is all about AWS CloudFormation change sets.
Much now more offering, terrestrial.
Yeah, now offering enhanced change visibility for deployments. That actually sounds like a really boring subject after where we just ended up. But let's get back on track. What are your thoughts on this one, John?
So CloudFormation chain sets, let's do a quick little definition. When you deploy a CloudFormation stack for the first time, you can just do create stack if you want to. And then from then on, if you want to make a change, you can do either update stack and it will just do it, or you can create a change set and then you execute the change set. And the change set basically takes the current state of the stack plus your new template and goes, what's the difference? What am I going to do? You know, I've added an RDS database, for instance. I'm going to go create a database. Great. Here's exactly what you're going to do, rather than just running it in. For Terraform users, that's basically looking at a plan and seeing that I'm going to add this one thing, rather than just doing a straight blind apply and letting it get on with it. I mean, both will, in theory, end up with the same net result. It will look like what you told it to, but things might have changed. You kind of want to know what's going on. Cool. They've always been a little bit basic, though, because in some cases you want it to go off, and Terraform has this problem as well, you want it to go off and grab things from SSM or Secrets Manager or whatever, and it will sort of go, well, I can't do that. I can't tell you what I'm going to go and get. I haven't done it. So you get a known after apply or known after we've finished sort of message. This is just giving you a bit more information into what it's going to do, which is nice. It's showing that it, what it will create, update, replace, or delete. You can look at them. You can kind of see what the deletion policies are going to do, before and after values of what does it say? Resource properties and attributes, such as deletion policies, which is important if you're doing like a create before delete, or you're actually removing a resource. You want to know what it's going to do before you kind of do it, and so on and so on. So this is, compared to our previous article, dull, but very interesting from an engineering perspective because it's useful. And to be honest, no one should be doing anything with CloudFormation other than creating change sets or doing flat deletes, because you can create a change set if there's no stack there. So you just always do that and build that into your pipeline. So it's doing the same thing every time, you know, and that way, if you need to build a process whereby a human goes and looks at what's going on for your delivery to production, for argument's sake, you can do that. So this is good. More information is always good. You know, more information, more better.
And here I want to throw a giant bucket of cold water, because change sets continue not to work with nested stacks. And if you're not familiar with CloudFormation, and you're a Terraform person, imagine that there were no modules and you had to write everything in one giant main.tf. I mean, that's essentially CloudFormation. So if you try to, I mean, and so I used to love CloudFormation. I used to give talks on CloudFormation. But if you're doing anything at reasonable scale, you want to break things up, and nested stacks are the terrible, terrible only answer for that. And so, you know, you said that in some cases a chain chest will say, well, I can't tell that, you know, until I do it. Well, it will say that about any nested stack. It's like, oh, you have a nested stack. I mean, so I was at a company where we had, you know, a main and then four nested stacks, and you run a chain set and it's saying, I might do something in any one of your four nested stacks. I don't know. And it's like, well, that's completely useless.
Yeah. I think I've blocked that part of my brain out because it hurts so much. I had a similar thing at a previous place. And again, nested stacks, because we were doing, it was just very Lambda, very serverless. So it was SAM rather than CloudFormation, but you know, meat and potatoes. And it was, here's all the things we need to happen before all of these Lambdas get deployed. And it was one per Lambda because permissions and logs and all the rest of it. And here's all the things we need to happen after it's been done for notifications and more logs and so on. And there might have been 20 or 30 Lambdas in one stack because of it was a set of functions that were related to each other. And you might have made one little update to one Lambda to make very minor code fix. And it's just gone, I can't tell you what I'm going to do in any of these nested stacks. So I'm going to open them, check them, close them all again every single time. So your deployment is never going to take less than 5 minutes for a one line change. Brilliant.
And you don't know what it's actually going to do. No. Right. Yeah. So other than that, it's totally useful.
They might fix that eventually. Hopefully.
Well, the thing is, I don't think they can. This is the thing. I mean, they did add modules, but I'd sort of given up on CloudFormation at that point. Sorry to my Amazon overlords, but they just don't really have a good solution.
You're an AWS ambassador, but you're clearly not a CloudFormation ambassador.
Well, like I said, I used to be, but then I saw the light, you know?
On that note, let's skip on to our next article for this week, which is about programmatic approaches to optimizing the cost of Amazon RDS snapshots. So we touched on Amazon RDS cost optimization in last week's episode when we gave an insight into various tools. This is a slightly different approach, is specifically around optimizing the cost of the snapshots themselves rather than the overall usage of RDS. John, thoughts on this one?
I mean, they're all sensible things, but I get the vibe that someone spent too much time playing around with trying to optimize their RDS costs and had to get a blog out of it to justify the time spent.
Maybe they had a lot of RDS.
Maybe.
A lot of snapshots. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, I mean, you can spend a lot of money, you know, on these things. I mean, how many, it's not exactly RDS, but I remember you used to get a 5 gig EBS anytime you did an EC2, and unless you were careful, you could, you know, leave those around. And I remember at some company looking and saying, oh my God, we have 5,000, literally 5,000 5 gig images someplace. It's like, no, get rid of them all.
Yeah, it's easy done. It's important to have things, controls in place so that you don't have an engineer going through as a quarterly task, making sure that these things have all been cleaned up. So it's important to do things programmatically. But like I say, it's this whole article is good, but it feels a little bit over-egged to me because they've got, you know, here's a solution overview that we've designed. Cool. Right, let's talk about it. Detailed report, instances with the number of snapshots, tuning retention periods, looking at old ones because they haven't been rotated out properly, looking at orphaned ones, to your point with EBS, but RDS can have the same problem, whereby you've deleted an RDS instance and it kind of wants you to hang on to the last snapshot, but you might have also had another 30 of them. So it's like, okay, well, we don't need all of these, do we? We probably need the last one. Cool. And you get this kind of nice big report from their solution, and it's great, it's wonderful, and it's useful. But it, I don't know, it, I just get a vibe from this when it's like, well, okay, there's this whole programmatic thing, and you've done this great work. Why can't you just build this into Cost Explorer and just tell me about it?
Right. And so I've got a silly comment and a serious comment. The silly one is, you said that it was all over eggs.
Over egged.
Oh, I thought this was going to be some Britishism of, it's over-egged, and it needed to be over beans and toast or something.
No. Okay. And it's not like the eggs over easy, because we don't have that. I remember the first time I went to the US and they asked me how one of my eggs cooked, and I just said fried. I didn't realize there was lots of different options of fried, like over easy, sunny side up. We don't really have that in the UK. Cooked. You just get fried or poached.
You have raw or unbelievably overcooked. Yeah. but the serious comment that I wanted to make was, anytime someone talks about backup, my immediate response is, and have you tested restore? Because having all these backups and worrying about how much you're spending on the backups may be over-egged, and I'm going to start using that term and tell people that
it's
you
very
taught me
British. That. It's very Southern England.
Right. But have you tested anything? Because, you know, until you've tested a backup, you really don't know that it works. And it's not just can you restore in RDS, because we believe, you know, we believe that works, but can the rest of your application handle it?
Hmm. So. Yeah, it's an excellent point. They do talk in here a little bit, I think, about AWS backup, I think, because that's definitely a way of dealing with it. And that certainly covers the first part of that, the can you actually restore these? Can you look at the data? But then, as you say, unless you've done this kind of full restore of everything else, which is arguably a DR test, does it all work? You know, has the backup and restore process mangled your data? Has it done something it really shouldn't have done? Can your application cope with the fact that maybe its backups aren't perfectly in sync with each other? Because they probably won't be.
Right. And have you backed up all the right things? I mean, back in the day, I was at a company. We were doing C++ development and doing our own local backups onto our little, you know, local 3.5-inch floppies. And there was a failure and we had to restore. And we discovered that we had backed up the CPP files, but not the HPP files, not the header files. And it's like, okay, we're screwed.
Yep. Got to be tested. Lots of ways to automate that now as well, which I think we've spoken about previously on the podcast. AWS have introduced new tools to help some of the automated testing, but only of those individual component snapshots, not the overall application. So,
Which is, I suppose, an argument for doing proper DR testing with infrastructure as code and kind of all the rest of it. It's moving regions is hard enough, but this is probably the best kind of use case for that. It's can we, on a semi-regular basis, take our infra code and take our backups, stick them somewhere else, bring the whole application up, and it actually work?
Yep.
And I mean, back in the day for me, which is probably 10 years ago now, I worked adjacent to sort of some teams that they would, every 2 weeks, every month, they would flip between their hot DR and their prod, and they'd just kind of flip-flop every 2 weeks, every month, just to make sure that it would keep working. And that way, eventually, you didn't ever know which one was prod beyond, you know, what was written on a bit of paper that said that this one was originally prod. But they were both equally capable. But that's obviously very expensive.
Well, that's what they do with America Cup boats as well. They have the A boat and the B boat, and they make a change in B and see if it's better and then switch it. So, God, I didn't think I'd ever make a jump from DR recovery to sailing, but there you go.
I've
clearly over-egged it.
Well, because you've gone to boats, I'm going to switch it up a little bit more, and I'm going to go to trucks. Our next article, sticking with modes of transport but getting off the ocean onto land, is about the demise of the snowmobile. So we've spoken on the podcast before, I think, about the snow family. We got very excited about the snowmobile, which was the 18-wheeler semi-trailer articulated lorry for our English listeners. That Amazon wheeled out onto stage at reInvent, whenever it was, a good few years ago, with lots of razzmatazz. There was an article this week on CNBC. They finally killed it. It's no longer available as a product. So that's a little bit sad. But, I guess its use cases were quite niche. What are your thoughts on this one, Brian?
Apparently I don't even think you have to read between the lines, but someplace they said they killed it because they didn't have any customers.
Yeah.
That no one was using it. And I was at the reInvent where they rolled it out, And it was very, very impressive. And we were waiting for the next year for them to roll out, you know, a railroad car or something. But the amount of data that you can store in a snowmobile was astonishing. Now, I actually wrote an article back then. Do any of you remember digital paper tape?
No.
Oh, it was tape about, you know, about this size. And you punched holes in it almost like a continuous feed punch card.
Oh yeah. I've seen that. Yeah.
And so, you know, it was very, very slow, of course. And I will say I used to work at DEC way back in the day. And at one point we were mischievous and set the paper tape to be the swap device. So it was this confetti machine. But I actually calculated how long a paper tape you would need to replicate a snowmobile.
Would it go around the planet?
What?
Did it go around the whole planet?
Oh, you're off by so many orders of magnitude. I calculated that you would need a paper tape that was 187 light years long.
which is probably more than all the paper tapes ever used in the history of paper tapes.
You could go.
That's more than the amount of paper that we could produce ever.
Yeah. You could go from Earth to Alpha Centauri and back 75 times.
Yeah, because that's 8 light years away, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think the sustainability folks might have something to say about that particular project. So.
Yes, maybe that's how we created the asteroid belt with all the little dots. But it is astonishing. I mean, in vague seriousness, I mean, the amount of data as we go to, I mean, what's after petabytes? Zeta?
Or Zeta? I don't know which comes next.
They don't have one for Q. They don't have one for R because they're Greek letters. Peta, Exa, and then Zeta, I think.
Zeta. But yeah, I mean, it is getting sort of silly. And it's, you know, I guess part of the thing is if you had that much data, you certainly can't. I mean, how would you move it around, or do you move it around? You know, is it just fully distributed?
It was certainly solving for a particular challenge. And the challenge was, and kind of still is, it's quicker to put a large amount of data on a physical storage medium and send the physical storage medium than it is to send it over even a high-speed connection. And this was 2016, so connections have gotten quicker since then. But they were talking back then about 10 gig connections and the amount of data that a snowmobile could hold would take 26 years to send over a 10 gig connection. Okay, cool. But I think we've run out of data centers to put things into the cloud from now is the vibe that I'm getting. Not that the world has, of course, but that it's the market's not there anymore because people have gone from we need to get all of our data into the cloud to now, okay, well, we'll live with what we've got on-prem and that will eventually become useless and everything net new is going direct. So whatever.
Right, but then how do you do DR? I mean, it's and one of the things was
with great expense.
Right. I think snowmobile was never available ever outside the US. But I mean, if y'all had, you know, crazy amounts of data in London and you wanted to run it in Sydney, I mean, how the heck would you do that?
We're back onto the subject of boats again, aren't we? I think.
Planes, trains, and automobiles.
Yeah. Right. Well, and undersea cables. I mean, I saw a study come out a couple of days ago, talked about how, you know, there are 3 cables that carry some, you know, 65% or something silly of all the world's traffic. And, you know, if bad agents attack those things,
Sharks are abnormally attracted to these things, apparently, because of electromagnetism. Lots of deeper sea sharks hunt through electromagnetism.
Oh, I see a disaster movie coming. because the shark bites the data stream and absorbs it and becomes super intelligent. Yeah. It's clearly the plot for Meg 3.
Nice. Well, on that note, I'm conscious of time, so let's skip on to our final article for this week. And this is an article penned by your good self, Brian, although maybe it was penned by AI. based on what you said at the beginning of the call. But certainly it's been published and accredited to you. And this one, the article is entitled Certification is Not Enough. And you go on to discuss the reasons why certifications are not enough and experience matters. So certainly we're seeing this with AWS now. Everyone is out there going through, you know, putting students and graduates through academies and everything else and getting them certified and churning out solutions architects ready for the market to employ. We saw it years ago with Microsoft as well, when every man and his dog was becoming a Microsoft certified systems engineer, and same sort of thing, putting people through academies, zero experience, lots of qualifications at the end of it. So I think you know, that's what this article goes on to discuss. So what are your thoughts on this, Brian?
Yeah, thanks. I recall years ago, God, all my stories are years ago. I need some new stories, but running to someone who had just graduated from school 3 years ago and had all at that time 8 Amazon certifications. And it's like, well, I'm sorry, but you still don't know anything. And, yeah. And, the metaphor for this particular article was, piloting, cause I'm a pilot on the side. You know, I'm instrument rated, but I'm not passenger. I can't take passengers. I don't have multi-engine or jet or any of that kind of stuff. In part, and I got my training up here in the Northeast, where, you know, there's clouds lots of times. And so there are lots of times when I simply couldn't fly. And there are schools in Arizona that say, we'll take you from zero to airport transport pilot rated in a month. And it's like, there's no way I'm getting on a plane with that person as a pilot, because they don't know anything. They haven't experienced all, you know, all the failures. And I think I always like metaphors to help understand things. It's like, I think most people wouldn't want to get on a plane like that. But I think people are like, I mean, people are either in the certifications are trash, they don't mean anything, don't bother getting them, or certifications are everything. And both extremes are terrible, of course. And so it's get some experience, you know, get some certifications. I will say, like, I really like all the marketing people to get the cloud practitioner, just so they understand the terms and they understand what we're talking about. And it seems like, oh my God, almost everybody has solutions architect associate.
Except John.
Yeah. I did all the other ones. I've done Dev and SysOps and DevOps Pro. I haven't done SA.
Okay. The two pro exams, I will say the solutions architect professional, that is a hard test. That is quite a hard test. I mean, because that one you really do have to understand, okay, so when would I use this, and when would I, and why would I use this over that? In that, you know, in the two pro certifications, you know, you're always given four answers, and generally all four of them are true. Yeah, or
none of them are great.
Right. But which one is best? And if of the four, if one of them involves a non AWS service, you can throw it right out. And almost always, if someone involves spots, you can generally throw it out, which I don't like because the test. But anyway, because I love spots. But so it's just, you know, do both. And you know, I know a lot of people are changing jobs now. The market is in such strange flux, and so it's like, yeah, get your, you know, get some certs, because you will learn some stuff, and it gives some baseline, but also then be able to talk about projects.
Certs are good because they get you past automated applicant tracking systems. They get you past HR departments and recruiters and that kind of thing. They kind of get you in the door. As you often see on kind of job specs, certified to this level or equivalent demonstrable experience. Cool. Okay, fine. Can do that. But the cert with little reference number says, yes, Amazon have validated that they do know what they're talking about within this scope, gets you through that door. But you're absolutely not wrong. It's the pilot thing's an interesting one, because certainly in the UK, you can't get a commercial rating without having done X number of hours. So it physically can't be done. Tech is not quite so life threatening, I suppose, as flying a plane, but arguably it could be.
Who do you think wrote the software that flies the planes?
Someone smarter than me.
But clearly, so clearly not someone smart enough to use the right bolts on the door.
Just a bit of silicone on that, that'd be all right.
So I guess one question to end on then, there is a huge skills shortage in the market. There are these academies that I referred to churning out lots of solutions architects with certifications, but no experience. What tips would you give those people to get experience, given that it's difficult for them to get a job without?
That's a great question. And one of my, and I've had that, several of my friends have asked that. I mean, it's funny. I actually just had lunch with one of the smartest people I know, and he could learn anything. You know, you could drop him into any job and he would figure it out. But, you know, he doesn't have a couple of the certifications. I mean, he does have the experience. I think, one way is to join an open source project. And that's good in general. There are lots of open source projects that have, you know, open pull requests or open, you know, feature requests. You know, jump on one of them, or you know, do it or write your own. You know, write a little project. I've actually have been chatting with someone who wrote a little project to take a picture of a bookshelf. And it would then use Amazon Vision to figure out what the titles were. I mean, to find the titles on the spines, and then use that to generate, to go through some database to figure out what the actual title was. And then it came up with, you know, a report. And, you know, no one paid him to do that, but it's like, geez, that's pretty cool. I mean, that actually demonstrates something.
Yeah, I think that'd be awesome if you turn up to a job interview with, you know, nothing on the resume. Why should I hire you? You've got no experience. Well, take a look at this thing that I built.
The other one that I've seen is answering questions on Stack Overflow or whatever AWS's equivalent of Stack Overflow is. Because again, it's a way of demonstrating knowledge. Because, oh, I've seen this in one of my personal projects. There you go.
Right. Well, that raises an interesting question. Is Stack Overflow, how relevant is Stack Overflow when, you know, it's funny. I hardly go there anymore, and I never go to Google anymore. I ask Perplexity, you know, but so it's sort of an open question, and Amazon has, you know, its own Q&A system as well. But
I certainly use it less than I used to. That's true. I'm not using the LLMs because I don't trust them. I tried with Amazon Q for a bit, and it just kept inventing stuff. So I'm like, okay, nope, don't trust that.
I have to say, do my obligatory I, for one, welcome our robot overlords. because I think they will remember. I mean, it's funny. If you say please, you get a better answer from them. And if you praise them, you get a better answer from them, which is terrifying. And I'll leave you with, if you haven't tried it, go to hume.ai. It's a conversational system, but with emotionality built in. So it listens to your emotions. It responds with emotionally cadenced voice. And, you know, you ask it a question and it will say, well, we could do this or we could do this. You want to brainstorm together? And it's terrifyingly like talking to a person. So
I'm going to check that out.
Yeah. Yeah. Hume.ai.
I've already typed it into my browser. But on that note, we have reached the end of our time for this week, for season 3, episode 16 of Logicast. So I'd like to thank you for joining us again. We must be doing something right, Brian, if you've come on for a third time. It's always
this is a blast. This is too much fun.
Great. Well, I'm glad you enjoy it. We enjoy having you on as our guest. So thank you, as always, for your insights. John, thank you, as always, for your insights as well. That was season 3, episode 16 of Logicast. If you enjoyed it, tell your friends. We are available to download from wherever you download your podcasts. And if you want to see what we look like, see the fantastic beards that we share with you every week, we're also on YouTube. We'll be back next week with another episode for you. In the meantime, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.